Mr. T.
And good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Alice.
I don't know whether I'm AA or Al-Anon. But I first want to thank you all so very, very much for wanting me to be with you. It's a great privilege for me, and I'm extremely happy. Your hospitality and devotion and affection have just swamped me. Thank you all for your great kindness. And it's wonderful to see so many happy faces here. Gives me a great, great thrill. When I said that I didn't know whether I was AA or Al-Anon, of course, AA was my first love. But I thought maybe I'd tell you a little bit about my life with Bill and how I came to really know that I did belong to both AA and Al-Anon. When Bill and I were first married, I found that he was drinking, to my great surprise, because during our engagement, which had been about 3 years, he hadn't touched a drop to drink. His family had told him that his father had drank too much and got into trouble, and his grandfather had drank too much and gotten into trouble, and he mustn't drink too much, or he surely would get into trouble. And he believed them. So I was very proud of him during our engagement, because he would go to the bars and saloons, as they called them in those days, with the other boys, and he'd order ginger ale or birch beer or something or other, sarsaparilla, they had in those days, while they had their beers. And I thought he was so strong-willed that he could look after himself in any situation. So, as I say, I was extremely surprised when we were married. He was stationed, it was during the First World War, and he was stationed at Fort Rodman, Massachusetts, which was a cotton manufacturing town. And there were lots of well-to-do socialites there. And the men, of course, were all gone to war, but the women would put on these cocktail parties for the men at the post. And it was there that Bill, at these parties, that Bill first took a drink of liquor. And I used to like to kid him and tell him that he couldn't resist the women, although he resisted the men when they offered him a beer, but he couldn't resist the gals when they offered him a cocktail. But although I was really quite shocked, but I didn't think it would be long before living with me would be so stimulating that he wouldn't need any artificial stimulus. But of course, the years went on, and he kept drinking more and more. At first, he always drank too much. He never drank moderately, but he didn't drink too often. But when he started, he just drank too much. And at the first party I went to with him, there in New Bedford, Massachusetts, after a little while, the boys came to me and said, we've just taken Bill home and put him to bed. So I immediately, of course, went home, and there he was in bed with a bucket at his head. So Bill drank until he was laid out every time. But as I say, it wasn't too often. And although I was shocked about it, yet I was sure that I could fix him. But year after year went by, and he got worse and worse. And as we had no children, it became my one purpose in life to help Bill get over this frightful habit, as I thought it was. But nothing seemed to work. We tried all kinds of things. And he was so remorseful and so anxious to stop his drinking that I never could be too harsh with him the morning after. I always had to say, well, better luck next time. You'll do it next time. But next time came, and the same thing happened again and again and again. I used to organize parties for the weekend. So Bill wasn't a weekend drinker the way so many people are. Somehow or other, I don't really know just what it was, but somehow or other, when we got into the outdoors, into the open air, and went on picnics or camping trips, hikes through the countryside, which Bill loved, he never drank during those times, or very, very rarely. So we'd have wonderful weekends together, and we'd do all kinds of silly things sometimes, depending upon our pocketbook, how much we had in the pocketbook. Sometimes we'd take a rowboat and put up a bath towel on an oar and sail up the Hudson River. And I remember one time we did that and camped on a spit that came out from Nyack, New York, across on the Jersey side. But the mosquitoes were so bad that we couldn't sleep. So we got back in the rowboat and put our blankets on the floor of the rowboat and anchored out in the channel where there was a good breeze to keep the mosquitoes away. But the great vessels that were coming up and down, going up and down the Hudson River, of course, would be honking out their toots or their horns at us or whatever it is you call them. And we had a very precarious night there on the Hudson in the midst of all these other big traffic. So as I say, we used to do a whole lot of silly things. And we did a lot of walking. One time this was when Bill first came home from overseas, and he didn't really know what he wanted to do. He hadn't had any profession when he went into the army during the war. So he didn't know what he was going to make his life work, what was going to be his life work. So we decided we'd take a month or so off, and we put our packs on our backs, and we walked across Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont, trying to decide just what he'd do. Of course, we had a wonderful, wonderful trip then, but he wasn't any surer when we got through, got home, than he was when he started. But he did take a law course at night, but he had only just ordinary jobs. He couldn't find anything that he wanted especially to do. But he thought he'd studied law anyway at night. So there were lots of wonderful and companionable times that we had together, in spite of the great unhappiness that we both felt because of his drinking. And he sincerely and earnestly wanted to stop and couldn't. And when finally that marvelous thing happened to him that you probably most of you have read about in the big book, when he had this wonderful spiritual awakening, I knew right off that he was a different person, that something tremendous had happened to him. And I never had any doubts from then on about Bill's drinking. I knew that was a thing of the past. And I can't express to you my gratitude for this wonderful, wonderful thing that happened to him. And of course, I was just walking on air. But by this time, Bill, of course, had no job, he had nothing. I'd had to support the family. I'd had to be mother, nursemaid, breadwinner. And suddenly, Bill was sober. And instead of the baby or child I'd had to look after all these years, Bill was a man, was my partner. And I was extremely happy, but I didn't know exactly where I stood. Before, I'd known how much I was needed. And I'd responded to that. But now, I didn't seem to be needed. I didn't know just where I stood. Especially when Bill, right after his own awakening, he wanted to help all the drunks in the world. He'd had this wonderful experience. He knew he was sober and was going to stay sober. Why couldn't this beautiful thing happen to others? Why couldn't it, in fact, happen to all the drunks in the world? And I think he must have brought nearly half of those drunks home to Clinton Street. Because we had the house full of drunks in all stages of sobriety and non-sobriety. And we had many ridiculous experiences, many inspiring experiences, and some tragedies there. But all this time, as I say, half of me was so grateful and wouldn't let me think about the other half of me, which was that I was really kind of left out now. I'd been important before. And this went on until one day when we were going to the Oxford Group meetings. Now, the friend who'd come to Bill to tell him about his own sobriety and how he had gotten it was a member of the Oxford Group, which was an evangelical movement. It did a lot of good in the early 30s and 40s, 50s. And we went very regularly to meetings with him. And Bill said to me one day, "Now hurry up and let's get ready and go to the meeting." And I had a shoe in my hand and I took that shoe and threw it just as hard as I could and said, "Damn your old meetings." This surprised me, I think, more than it did Bill. I wondered why had I lost my temper? at such a simple, natural remark as he made. What could it be that had upset me? I wouldn't let myself think that I was upset at all. But until this moment, I hadn't thought about myself in relation to Bill and to man and to my God. I'd taken myself for granted. I'd been brought up in a good religious home, and I'd had loving parents, and it never occurred to me that I hadn't behaved as a good wife should. I'd done all I could. I wanted so to be helpful. And as I say, I'd thought that I was on the credit side of the ledger and that Bill had been on the debit side. I just never stopped to analyze myself at all. And when I did, after this shoe-throwing episode, it was just a start, that shoe-throwing episode. It just started me to think and to wonder about my own behavior and my own attitudes. And it's taken me all these years, and I'm still doing it, to wondering about why I'm not just the same, the person that I think I should be. Well, as I say, it's been many, many, many years since those early days, and a lot of water has flown under the bridge. But it wasn't long after that shoe-throwing episode that I began to really get down to brass tacks with myself. And I realized that I was resentful about these newfound friends that Bill had. That I was jealous of Ebby, who had come to Bill and sobered him up. I had tried to sober Bill up for 17 years, and I hadn't been able to do it. And here somebody had come along, and in a few minutes talk with Bill, and Bill was somebody completely different. And I had really been very, very much hurt by this. So I went along then to these meetings, not just because Bill was going, which had been my motive previously, but because I needed to go, because I needed spiritual development. Finally woke up to that fact. Then, of course, Bill went on with getting more and more drunk, the house, and he went to Akron, and he met Bob, and AA really started at that time. And it went on and on, kept growing, and many exciting things happened. The book was written, the AA book, and the AA conference was formed, the traditions were written. And then, back in 1950, I guess it was, Bill was interested to find out what the AA groups felt about a conference of delegates. Bill felt that the AAs themselves should have should have the say over their own affairs. So he went out through all the groups to get their opinion and to see how they reacted to the idea of a conference of delegates. And when he came back, he told me about his experiences. And he said, you know, there were a whole lot of groups of the families of alcoholics. And I think something should be done with them. Before this, Annie Smith and I had, when we'd gone to meetings, we had told her about how we had come to realize that we needed to live by these same principles that the AA did. And we always told our friends about this. And then when Bill went out on this trip, he found these groups of people. Some of them had just gotten that idea spontaneously. The families of alcoholics had gotten this idea spontaneously. And some had heard Annie talk about it, and some had heard me talk about it. Because back in the early days, there was a tremendous amount of traveling between the groups. Before there was a lot of literature, that was the only way to get a group started, was to go there. So Bill and I did a tremendous amount, lots more of traveling than Annie and Bob, because they were older and they weren't as well physically as Bill and I were. So we used to get around a lot in the early days. So he suggested, when he returned from this trip, he suggested that I start a fellowship, an office for the families of alcoholics, a place where they could write for information, where they could meet other AA, other Al-Anons. You see, I don't know which I am. They always kid me back in the office because I talk about the grapevine instead of the farm. I'll mention AA as I started to then instead of Al-Anon. Well, anyway, Bill suggested that I start a central office for the groups of families. We had been quite surprised and disappointed in the early days of AA to find that the families were not as happy as they should be. After this wonderful program had come to the alcoholic, we thought everything should be simply marvelous in the home. But it wasn't. There was something missing. And of course it was that the family was not going along too, were not living the same program. So I asked a friend of mine if she would help me. It was another Anne Bingham this time, to help me start an office for the families of alcoholics. Of course, we didn't know what to call it, but we thought we made up the name Al-Anon from Alcoholics Anonymous and sent out a questionnaire asking the groups whether they would like to use that name and whether they'd like to use the 12 steps of AA as the principles that they would live by. And we had gotten from AA, to our surprise, 87 names of people that had called up or written to the AA office for information about the families of alcoholics. And the AA, of course, was not equipped to send out any information about alcoholics, about the families. They were only equipped to deal with alcoholics. So they just kept these names. They'd answered the letters politely, but that was all they could do. So there were 87 names when Ann and I asked them to send us any names they had. And we wrote to them all, and we got 50 answers, which I think was really a very good percentage. And so Al-Anon really started with 50 groups. And then Ann and I asked them about the name, as I say, and about the principles, and they wrote back and said, of course, they'd like to live by the AA principles. And then Ann and I got so busy that we couldn't keep up with our work up in Bedford Hills, where I lived. She used to come and help me there. So we moved to New York. And the AA is offered their upstairs room in the clubhouse. They had a clubhouse on 24th Street in New York. The first clubhouse in the world, by the way. And we started our little Al-Anon office there. And we got in a lot of volunteers. We went around, Ann and I, and the father of an alcoholic, Wally. Wally came with us. We went around to the groups, and there were maybe about five or six groups around the New York area at that time. And we went there, and we asked for delegates, and volunteers, I mean, for our service office. And we really had five or six very dedicated people that came in. We only met once a week at first, and then we had to come twice a week, and then we had to get a regular paid secretary, and Henrietta was the one chosen to be the regular secretary, and she's been there ever since, all these years, since this was 51, in 1951 that we started it. And she's been our executive director ever since. So Al-Anon was, and so that the trail was very much easier to follow. But nevertheless, we feel that it's been a remarkable God-given program that we have here. And I can't tell you how grateful I am for the love Al-Anon program. And it's so marvelous now to see that AA and Al-Anon are walking together, hand in hand. And I hope that they will continue so for as long as God shall need them. I thank you.